Hello and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday 25th September with me, Ian Welsh. A few weeks ago, Innovation Forum held the first in our Smallholder Farmer Workshop series in the run-up to the Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities Conference in November. Following the workshop, I caught up with Golden Agri-Resources Head of Sustainability Implementation, Gots Martin. We talked about finding solutions for viable smallholder farmer communities and some of the obstacles that prevent participatory conservation planning, including land title questions, insufficient incentives, lack of government support, and upfront costs. First up, though, is the usual roundup of some sustainable business news. New York Climate Week has coincided with a further rash of corporate commitments to net zero emissions. Last week, we talked about the big tech sector's targets, and overall, the number of companies and governments pledging to deliver net zero emissions by 2050 has more than doubled in the past 12 months. New research says that among business alone, the number of companies pledged to net zero goals has jumped from 500 to over 1,500 since the start of 2019. Among regional governments, 101 are now pledged to net zero, alongside 823 cities. With a nod to the COP26 Climate Summit in Glasgow, postponed to 2021, the UK government has unveiled a series of new initiatives to encourage more business and company commitments. These include an Energy Transition Council to encourage the move from coal to renewables in developing economies. The council will include leaders from government, finance and technology. COP26 President Alok Sharma, UK Business Secretary, has also urged governments to submit more ambitious, nationally determined contributions, to pledge to reach net zero emissions as soon as possible, and to consider climate adaptation in all planning decisions. Not to be left behind, Walmart has announced a goal to become a regenerative company as part of a net zero emissions by 2040 target. To achieve this, the company will switch to sufficient sources of wind, solar and other renewable energy to power its facilities by 2035, electrify its entire vehicle fleet by 2040, and introduce other measures including switching to low-impact refrigerants and electric heating. Currently, only 29% of the business's operations are powered with renewable energy. In addition, Walmart and the Walmart Foundation have pledged to restore or protect 50 million acres of land and 1 million square miles of ocean, adopt regenerative agriculture practices, sustainable fisheries management and forest protection and restoration, and to invest in suppliers to develop efforts to preserve ecosystems and improve community livelihoods. Plastic pollution continues to be top of the NGO community's agenda. A new report from the Changing Markets Foundation accuses top brands and FMCG businesses of hypocrisy on plastic, lobbying against stronger plastic legislation at the same time as having public commitments to cutting pollution risks. There are some big names in the firing line: Unilever, Coca-Cola, Colgate-Palmolive, Danone, Mars, Nestle and PepsiCo among them, standing accused of being members of trade bodies that have lobbied against stricter rules on plastics. The report says that the companies continue to try to externalise responsibility for plastic use onto consumers, and that costs of tackling the platform should be borne by government, both central and local. The brands are also accused of being slow to develop more easily recyclable packaging materials, while at the same time promoting behaviour-changing programmes and clearer labelling, on the face of it encouraging recycling rates. Many of the companies have countered the accusations, pointing to progress towards challenging binding targets and the need for continual improvement and cooperation. In sum, however, this is a reminder that for brands, plastic pollution will remain a potentially toxic reputation issue and an environmental challenge in which consumers and NGOs will expect progress. There was some better plastic pollution news with the winning of a James Dyson Award by a device that captures microplastic particles from tyres at the point of them being emitted. A group of London-based graduate students from Imperial College and the Royal College of Art combined to develop a prototype device that is attached to the wheel and collects up to 60% of particles using electrostatic technology. Microparticles from tyres emitted every time a vehicle accelerates, brakes or goes around a corner are the second largest cause of microplastic pollution in the oceans after single-use plastics. Estimates suggest that over 500,000 tonnes of material is emitted by tyres in Europe alone. The tiny fragments are washed into watercourses and eventually into rivers and oceans. Winning the UK James Dyson Innovation Award, the prototype device will now compete for the International Dyson Prize. Innovation Forum's 2020 Future of Plastics Conference is rapidly approaching. It will be held via our interactive online platform over 3 days from 20th to 22nd of October. Among the expert panellists already confirmed are representatives of Coca-Cola European Partners, Dow Chemical Company, Tesco, Anheuser-Busch InBev and Greenpeace. And the first week of November this year sees Innovation Forum's Sustainable Landscapes and Commodities event. This will include a series of focused interactive workshops around an extended conference over 3 days from 3rd to 5th November. Already signed up to take part are senior representatives from Sime Darby, April, Tate & Lyle, WWF, Burger King and the Consumer Goods Forum. All details are on innovationforum.co.uk. We recently convened a workshop exclusively for conference delegates and have another coming up on the 8th of October when we will consider the next generation of smallholder farmers and what will be required to empower them. Sign up for the November event now and you can participate in the October workshop. Also coming up is the next in our webinar series on the 29th September, when we will be debating on-farm data that ensures benefits across supply chains, and then on the 8th of October, when we'll ask how to make a company forest positive. Sign up for free via the links in this week's newsletter or on the Innovation Forum website. Among the participants in the Smallholders Workshop in a few weeks will be Golden Agri-Resources Head of Sustainability Implementation, Gutz Martin. We caught up a few days ago to reflect on the first workshop in the series, held earlier in September, that focused on how to incentivise smallholders and rural communities to protect forests. In general terms, what do you think characterises best practice when engaging with smallholder farmer communities?
The best thing in engagement with smallholders is really that you see this engagement as an opportunity and not as a burden. And I think that was in the past, right? In the past, so a lot of smallholder engagement is in Indonesia, at least, is government mandated and it was seen as a burden by companies. I think now this is really shifting towards seeing it as an opportunity, right? The smallholders are an opportunity to fulfill your no deforestation commitments. Smallholders are an opportunity to expand your supply base and fill up your mills, which might not be fully utilized. And I think with that in mind, that's the right approach to work out solutions. An example I want to share with you briefly on this is that our approach in CSR has made a tremendous shift from charity approaches, where you give one time, sometimes even cash payments in the past, while now everything is focusing on more strategic, forward-looking initiatives, which really lead to a lasting change in the community or to a lasting increase of funds being available for these communities.
We're seeing that in for lots of companies moving from the philanthropic approach to actually a business-led approach. And in fact, once we have a business-led approach in place, that's when difference can be made for the long term, I would think.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Also, we touched on it yesterday a little bit, but if you engage with communities on conservation, it needs to be also a business perspective for the communities, right? Pay for performance schemes, we all know the models. If communities can really see that as a business and can tell about themselves, oh, my job is forest conservation, then you have a reliable long-term solution.
To what extent then is paying farmers to preserve forests the solution?
It's part of the solutions. Everything needs to lead to a certain income level. We know from Western countries, as soon as the GDP per capita is exceeding a certain level, deforestation stops. People have time to be concerned about nature and environment, and deforestation stops and is revised. We need to bring these communities to that income levels where they can be concerned about the environment. And so I think that it's a combination of things, right? There will be surely employment in large agribusiness firm like ours. There is an increased income from farming activities, what they do on their own privately. I strongly believe that payments for ecosystem services like carbon or fresh air as a commodity, yeah, to put it into naive, simple words, is one of these different income streams which would go into the community and into the pocket of the individual farmers.
We talked about ecosystem services a bit during the workshop. What for you are the main challenges around payments for ecosystem services?
A big challenge is still that investors have many requirements which need to be fulfilled before they are willing to write the check. There is a lot of mapping needs to be done, baselining needs to be done, justifications on business as usual scenarios, how the forest would disappear without intervention. For sure, all these assessments cost money. Yeah, it's either your own workforce, which you need to divert from other activities, or you need to hire consultants or work with an NGO and so on. So it's a money and time component. The other difficult part in Indonesia, at least, and I hope for other countries that it's better there, is the land tenure, right? And by default, in Indonesia, officially all land is owned by the state. There are programs at the moment by the Indonesian government where indigenous people's rights are being recognized, but it's relatively slow, right? I think to date we are talking about in the ballpark of 10 million hectares, which has been returned to the people, if you will, and out of 180 million. Every investor, every bank would say, oh, if that individual or that community has not a clear legal title to the land, they are not bankable, right? Or they are not ready for that investment. Going there is a complicated process. The communities need to support. They would need to deal at multiple government levels. Multiple ministries are involved to make it happen. It's doable, no question. But again, it would take time and again, money. So, right? So if we say, for example, now, as an example, we are going now into a village which doesn't have land titles. Even if we would work in multiple work streams in parallel, we are talking at least 2, 3, 4 years until we would be ready. The investor would be maybe willing to engage. Yeah. And then you still have not done your first verified no deforestation year. And so keeping these communities motivated to go through that lengthy process, I think that is the major challenge.
Yeah, so the time-consuming element, the fact that you've got farmers and farming communities that really need funds now, they don't have the luxury of being able to wait for a number of years before they have the funds coming in. So I guess that's a major concern. What other obstacles are there preventing participatory conservation planning, do you think?
Communities, again, in Indonesia, Kalimantan, Sumatra, are not as a very homogeneous group, actually. In these villages I see, there are village elites which have power. They are landless people. If you follow a participative approach, getting that alignment within that village is actually not so easy. Most often it would require that the village elites let go a little bit from their power to have the poorer in the community participate. And that is very often a difficult discussion. Second, obviously, these forests, they don't stop in concession boundaries and they also don't stop in village boundaries. Now, again, we have a quite heterogeneous groups in our mini landscapes, which we are operating as GAR. We often find multiple ethnics in these mini landscapes. And so overcoming these ethnical barriers to be willing to cooperate, that is also an issue which we are quite often experiencing. And then, you know, if the communities cannot agree on the boundaries, then we are going back to the level where the investor would not invest, because if the area he's investing in is not clear to whom it belongs to, no investment.
What about incentives then? I mean, we talked a lot about incentives yesterday. What are the incentives that are required to enable communities to get involved?
So I think it's a combination of things. And I think a financial incentive is one thing. I think yesterday was a very interesting point was raised. If as a smallholder farmer, it's a very risky business. You are exposed to natural disasters, potentially. You are exposed to markets where prices go up and down very quickly these days. And what you essentially want is stability. And so I think everything which leads to this stability could be seen as an incentive. For example, what we are doing right now, we are engaging in alternative livelihood options and what we are helping with in the beginning, mainly on food security. So we help the farmers to grow crops which they don't grow at the moment. Even these efforts can lead to, in our examples, to savings per household of $100-$150 per month. You know, if you have suddenly that amount of money as free cash available to invest into your kids' education, as an example, that is a huge incentive. And then you see these champions in the villages who lead that process and the others are following. So it's really everything which leads to a more stable life, I would say, is beneficial. And that could be pure financial transactions, capacity, skills, simple stuff, again, like access to fertilizer, access to good quality seedlings, which need to higher yields, etc. Yeah, it's a broad range of topics and not limited to a pure financial payment. Yeah.
What's the role of government then in helping here?
The role of the government is support on the land tenure question, right? Easing the process to get land tenure, easing that an area which the government spatial plan has been assigned as an area which can be developed for industrial or agribusiness development or mining can be more easily transferred into an area which allows conservation. These type of things, right? I think there is a lot of red tape, a lot of bureaucracy involved. And so making that process more smooth would be hugely beneficial.
Ultimately, this all kind of boils down to finding the solutions that allow farmers to develop and increase their incomes and develop more viable communities, farming, smallholder farming communities, at the same time as preserving the forests and thinking hard about how to maintain standing forests. I mean, is that for you what we are ultimately trying to do?
Definitely. These farmers need to have a viable future in the place where they are. If they see it's worthwhile for them to preserve and to conserve the forest, and so therefore everything, again, what leads to a stable life where they have prospects to develop in the location where they are, that will lead, even as a byproduct, to forest conservation in that area.
It's one of these things where it's a seemingly simple goal, but in fact, it's a very complicated journey to get there.
You know, we want to retain a workforce there in the future. And so therefore, in our best interest to engage in these villages to make sure these people want to stay there in the future, give them a decent living. So we are helping with these opportunities, and hopefully it will soon also lead to ecosystem payments, which then could add up to the portfolio, which lifts the income of the smallholder farmers.
There's still a lot to do, obviously, but it's very exciting to see so many innovative solutions developing. Fascinating talking with you as always, Gotz, but Gotz Martin from Golden Ag Resources, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ian, for having me.
As ever, there's plenty more insight and analysis available on innovationforum.co.uk, including the usual audio, interviews and podcasts. And don't forget to sign up for our two webinars on the 29th of September and the 8th of October. But that's all for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next week.